ExchangeWire's ATS Singapore conference returns on July the 2nd. Grab your ticket now and secure your place. You'll hear the latest on retail media, curation for marketing, the impact of AI on the industry, and much, much more. ATS Singapore 2025 will feature the latest insights from an exceptional group of speakers, highlighting future challenges and breakthroughs in media, marketing, and e-commerce. Visit exchangewire.com/events for more details.
Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Amy, editor at ExchangeWire, and your host today. I'm joined by ExchangeWire CEO, Rachel Smith. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Amy. Pleasure to be on the podcast.
Great to have you here. And our guest today, Matt Rance, head of commercial data and analytics at Immedia. Welcome, Matt.
Hello, thank you. Great to be here as well.
Yeah, great to have you here for our in-person podcast today.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's nice mixing it up. So many Zoom versions of these. It's good to have an in-person one.
Yes.
I know. Yeah. Sun is shining as well, but you know, things are great and we're about to head into the Easter long weekend as
exactly.
Well.
Exactly.
So the vibes are good.
Pre-holiday giddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, something nice to look forward to. So today we'll be discussing the tariff exemptions introduced by Trump for the tech industry, the drop in investment for UK startups, and Meta's antitrust trial in the US over its social media dominance. So our first story on the US tariff exemptions is from TechCrunch. The Trump administration has carved out tariff exemptions for the tech industry. US Customs and Border Protection posted a list of product categories which are excluded from the reciprocal tariffs. The categories include smartphones, laptops, hard drives, and machines that make semiconductors. Those products will all be exempt from both the 125% tariff on goods from China and also from the universal baseline tariff. So Matt, I'll come to you first. Are these exemptions good for the ad tech industry? What do you think?
Yeah, so really easing us into the episode, I guess, with this one. Look, there's a lot to discuss here, I think. First point, before sort of addressing the question directly, I think it is worth noting the sort of tacit acknowledgement here, if you like, from Trump that, you know, when it comes to these tariffs, they're paid by the importers, not the exporters, which I think it's been the opposite that's been really sort of integral to Trump's thesis up until this point, which is interesting, let's say, if not anything else. I did also read that was interesting. I think it was the day before this U-turn, perhaps, Apple apparently flew 600 tons of iPhones out of India to the US.
Did they?
Yeah, which, in case you're wondering, is about 1.5 million iPhones.
And that sort of feels like it would barely touch the sides of what might be actually consumed in the US, but that's still significant effort, right?
I suspect, you know, an indication of the sort of, you know, the panic and the hysteria that was sort of bedding in pre-U-turn. But yeah, I think like there's some interesting things here to unpick. The bigger picture here, I would say, if we consider whether this is sort of good, bad news, I suppose it depends on whether your, you know, tendency for sort of glass half full or half empty. I think what I will say, unquestionably, what this has done is really set in a sort of strong sense of uncertainty and unease within, obviously, just the economy broadly, but therefore, by definition, you know, brands and, you know, our industry more specifically. And I think it's this uncertainty, this unease, which is, it's quite difficult to see it going away anytime soon, really, in my view, regardless of what Trump does at this stage. Of course, you know, this U-turn on face value is good news. And I'm, you know, I'm sure we'll come on to this. There's definitely some pros to it, but it's hard at this point to see, regardless of what this administration does, the extent to which it's really going to kind of impact that sense of certainty right now. And of course, what happens when brands feel uncertain? They hold back, they hold out, they kind of ride the storm. And, you know, our perspective and what we tend to see, a lot of the time at least, is that in these moments of unease, what's one of the first things that you pull? It's your marketing budgets, right? It's those things that don't feel necessarily like a complete necessity. You got to think, right? For your average brand, you're looking at this and you're thinking, who knows what my manufacturing and distribution chain could look like 6 months from now? Therefore, how can I possibly commit to these large marketing budgets right now. I'm going to hold back. I'm going to ride it out and see kind of how this all pans out. There was an interesting story actually this morning within the FT, make of this what you will, the IPA.
Yes, I read that.
Yeah, right. Again, comes down to this sort of half full, half empty piece, but they're suggesting that advertisers at least saying in Q1, due to the concerns, I think anticipation more than anything around the tariffs, that budgets have shrunk in the first quarter. But I suppose, look, taking a slight step back, even if budgets aren't cut entirely, brands will have a tendency, perhaps disappointingly in some respects, to cut out those more upper to mid-funnel stuff, right? Those things that feel a bit more like a luxury. And in those moments of, you know, challenge and hardship, there is more of a focus towards those things you can measure, things you can quantify, those kind of more metric-driven advertising, which, guess what? The walled gardens, right? The guys we know, we've been speaking about for years, that do a very good job of at least creating that perception of being able to deliver that very well. And that's not necessarily a great thing in the short to midterm for obviously premium publishers who candidly aren't as good at that, right? And for all the reasons that we're aware. So I think, you know, from that perspective, a challenge, I think we'll short to midterm see some difficulties there just due to the huge sense of unease and uncertainty that's kind of bedding in.
Yeah, it's definitely reflected by those findings from the IPA. But it did say that the outlook is quite positive. So I guess, yeah, hopefully.
Well, that was what was interesting, right? Yeah. It said that it wasn't necessarily at this stage impacting the sort of predicted growth rate, that growth advertising spend is still predicted to grow throughout the year. But maybe we're looking at a slower growth rate than we would have otherwise. I don't know. It's a bit difficult to tell. And you know, further to what you said as well, Matt, some of that I think is perceived. It's a pause on, well, it's a reduction on budget allocation, otherwise known maybe as a pause on further spend, because of anticipated difficulties. I think the big thing was, and this is UK advertisers that the IPA was talking about, UK marketers, the government's budget from last year, which has significantly increased staffing and supply costs. And so that's one of the things that's made people slow down on their marketing and advertising budget spend.
But yeah, I guess we've already kind of looked there at the wider ad industry. But looking at the other tariffs imposed by the US, how could this affect the tech industry and the ad tech industry as well?
So I think that what's really important is that in general, as Matt said, this is just injecting a whole load of uncertainty into the financial outlook for us all globally, quite frankly. You know, what's the saying? America bleeds and the rest of the world hurts. Like, it's, you know, it we're all so interconnected. So injecting such a high volume of uncertainty into the economy at a massive scale, which is what this tariff and trade war shenanigans has done, is definitely going to have an onward impact to most industries. I think, though, that Matt raises a good point, which is, you know, when marketers start to restrict their budgets and either reduce them altogether or just start to get really focused on where they're spending them and on what they're spending them, then they might follow a flight to safety, which could be more measurable things. There is a slight upside, I think, for the ad tech industry in that, which is if you're talking about more measurable forms of advertising, then you are talking about potentially programmatic advertising and other forms of digital advertising, which could be not necessarily display. But you are right. That's a double-edged sword there. A lot of that money we expect to still drift towards walled gardens, but not in all cases, right? We know that there is enough diversity in the advertising technology stack of today that we expect brands and marketers and their agency partners to be able to look for opportunities to spend elsewhere outside of those walled garden environments and using other tech tools to get the kind of ROI that they really need out of that advertising investment. So it could be an opportunity in that sense. However, the general sort of picture for tariffs and what that's doing to trade is just so unpredictable. I don't think any of us can sit here and say what we think things are going to look like quite frankly, even next week, but most certainly in another quarter's time. Personally, what I hope is that this period of flux will calm down, because a lot of this will be contained. It's basically gone from a sort of tariff policy to an all-out trade war with China. So I'm hoping some of that will calm down, because if enough economic chaos ensues from this ongoing trade war with China, then I think the US will be in the same position it was in a couple of days ago, which is what made Trump do some of his U-turns, which is that interest rates get pushed too high, bond markets collapse, and the US government can't borrow money to service their debt anymore, which is the real trigger, I think, that's behind a lot of this. And so if they keep, if China and the US keep pushing against each other enough and they get another version of that scenario, then that's obviously going to put a pin in the balloon a bit. And also there's lots of negotiations underway at the moment, which I expect to ramp up. You know, there was fascinating news yesterday or a couple of days ago about NVIDIA investing more in technology infrastructure in the US, and then discovering today that they've got a $5.5 billion fee applied to some of their exports to do with semiconductors that's picked up in the US government's export policies as a result of all of this trade nonsense. And so the CEO of NVIDIA is on the plane to Beijing, and who knows what that's about. But I feel like there's lots of conversations happening that could calm what's going on between China and the US and make some of the trade, some of the tariff policies and tariff applications calm right down. That will inject a bit of stability into the economic markets in a general sense and start helping people to feel a bit less reluctant and give people a bit more confidence. What often follows that sort of brand, as that sort of marketer and advertiser reluctance to spend, is also consumer confidence wobbling as well. You know, you could argue that they're linked. In the industry, maybe we would. Brands and marketers stop advertising, consumers stop buying. But once you start to see real concern amongst consumers, that's when I think the markets then react again, and that's where you start to see a lot more volatility in our sector. The only other thing that I think is at play here, of course, is talk of the US potentially slipping into recession because of the strain that all of this is causing on the financial markets and on the on interest rates and the cost of goods and services. So that will be a bit, that will be another thing that will perhaps bear consequence here. But also, if we look at what's happened in financial markets globally over the last 5 years since COVID, it's been an incredible time of volatility, and the advertising industry has still done pretty well. And advertising spend has still done okay. And if you look at one of the industry's well-known analysts and commentators, Brian Weiser, who runs Madison and Wall over in the US, he said, I think mid last week, when all of the tariff volatility was just going crazy, that he wasn't readjusting his forecast for ad spend for 2025 yet, because it was already quite modest once Trump was elected. And his whole thesis is we are going into a period of political instability, and that will have an impact on ad spend, but it's not going to be disastrous. It's probably just going to be a bit slower and a bit lower than we expected. To what extent that really impacts everyone in the ad tech industry is much more variable, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it is worth noting we are, in some respects, really, it's sort of in the eye of the storm, right? It's the world is flying around us right now. We're at the heart of it. There's a huge degree of recency bias right now. It's sort of, it all focuses on Trump and the chaos there. And I think, hopefully, a month or two from now, maybe I'm being ambitious, but some of this stuff will start to improve. Egos will start to settle slightly, and there'll be a degree of pragmatism that starts to settle in, perhaps. And there'll be cause for more sort of optimism. I think it is interesting to reflect on that point about, sure, in the short term, perhaps lots of advertisers are, holding back slightly, but it's not a long-term trend. It's also interesting to reflect on perhaps where some of that investment is going elsewhere in the short term. Perhaps I would hazard a guess into AI and kind of, shorter term projects, initiatives there. There is also this notion, right, of, I think, worst case scenario, as you point out, is recession. Some analysts saying now, I think 60-70% chance of perhaps global recession. And this idea of, you know, necessity being the mother of invention. I think, you know, prior to this tariff chaos, we've been speaking in our industry for quite a while now about us being almost on the cusp of, you know, potential kind of radical change and innovation with our industry, right? We have this incredible new technology now in generative AI that sort of hit the market in the last couple of years. And it's interesting, Martin Sorrell, I think, framed it in this way of we had the kind of wow, how, and now. I think the first year was this, wow, this is absolutely incredible. What on earth is this new thing that's, you know, sort of hit us all? And the next year, which I believe was last year, was supposed to be all about, okay, how can we use this? What can we build? And this year supposedly is, right, we need to be doing this now. We need to be building product services around this. I would argue we're not quite there yet. But really my point would be, you know, if the worst case is recession, but indeed even if it doesn't get that bad, I think it does potentially create, you know, that pressure, that necessity for us to move faster towards where we'd be going anyway, right? There's a lot of very serious, very smart people talking about very radical change that's going to take place in our industry, you know, the post-web era and things like that. We do have this remarkable new technology now that could completely overhaul the way that we think about digital advertising and ad tech. You know, Brian O'Kelly and his recent announcement in the last couple of weeks around kind of agentic-based advertising. I think we are really poised for some rapid and incredibly exciting innovation, regardless of what happens here. And perhaps even if it does get more challenging, it will only speed that up because there'll be more of a need for us to rethink the way in which we sort of approach things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point, right? That, you know, chaos and turbulence doesn't always mean bad times. You know, there's lots of innovation that comes out of that type of environment. And, you know, as I said, we've only got to look at what we've lived through in the last 5 years to understand that we're no longer, I don't think, living in a world or an environment where there is one big jolt to the economy and everybody's lives falls apart and you know, it's recession for years and years and years to come. I just don't think that's exactly how global markets work anymore. There's too many other things at play, and we're definitely at a period in history of intense technological innovation, and there's therefore huge amounts of opportunity in
That's why, you know, there's a degree of irony, your point around NVIDIA, with them imposing now further restrictions on these chips. I mean, how did that work out for them prior? We saw the emergence a couple of months ago of DeepSeek.
Exactly.
And this model that was basically at parity with the best in class at the time when they had these significant restrictions imposed on them. And it goes back to that point, right, that, you know, when you're under that significant pressure, you are forced to innovate, think about things in entirely different ways. And obviously in those conditions, you can do incredible things. And we saw that with DeepSeek. And we'll continue to, you know, ad tech is incredibly vibrant, creative, exciting. So, you know, I think most of us are still naively optimistic.
Yeah. Yep. Like I said, pre-holiday giddiness, naively optimistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point there. All these chaotic times can definitely lead to more innovation and positive things, hopefully. So now let's move on to our next story, which is from the FT. Investment in UK startups has fallen to a post-pandemic low. Figures from research company Dealroom showed that British startups raised just $16.2 billion in 2024, which was the lowest since 2020. Meanwhile, Silicon Valley peers raised more than $65 billion over the same period. As a result, leading tech groups are considering moving their headquarters to the US in search for capital. So, Matt, how could UK startups moving their company headquarters to the US impact the UK tech landscape?
So, yeah, there was another interesting stat within this, right, that I read that apparently, I think global venture that went into the US startup economy rose last year to 60%. And I think in the UK, it was 5%, which was down 11%. I think that's probably the most alarming piece, if you like, within this article is not so much the difference between the UK and the US, to be honest with you, because we know the US is significantly bigger. There is always going to be a difference in those numbers, but I think it's that trend, it's that direction of travel. It's worth noting that, look, if you speak to UK ad tech, at least, which is obviously a very good proxy, if you like, for the tech industry more widely, they'll say that, yes, this is absolutely the case. This article is, you know, bang on. The UK is very good at supporting early stage kind of, you know, pre-seed startup with some of the kind of tax schemes in place. But really beyond that, it gets incredibly hard to continue to scale. What's interesting is that for a lot of companies now, again, as I understand, UK-based ad tech startups, is they typically do sort of one or two things. They tend to either base themselves in the UK from the beginning, knowing that it's inevitable for them to move over to the US at some point, do the so-called Delaware flip. Once they need more funding and really need to kind of grow at scale, where, you know, it's much easier for them to secure more funding, to, you know, go for IPO, much more kind of M&A opportunities and things like that. Or perhaps even more interesting, they set up a holding company in the US from the beginning, but their focus in the early stages is still on the UK European market, which I think is possibly one of the more kind of potentially regrettable instances and where maybe some of those kind of threats or risks can come in. I think the issue with that, you know, in those cases where companies, UK companies, are basing themselves in the US but focusing, you know, their initial kind of client base on UK and European side of things, is, well, most obviously, you know, UK isn't generating kind of tax revenue from that. It's going to go to the US, you know, not helping the economy, obviously. But my concern with this is really a point around sort of dilution of strategic focus, if you like. It's very difficult, I would say. Depends a little bit, I think, on the product or the service that you're providing, but very difficult if you're sort of straddling different markets based in the UK or based in the US and sort of, you know, also focusing on UK and Europe as well, particularly in the earlier stages, to really commit, prioritize and give strategic focuses to all sides, you know, particularly when you're sort of resource light in those earlier stages. We know in ad tech, at least, that UK versus US, for example, are very similar in lots of ways. There's a lot of things in common, but there are also a lot of differences. There's a lot of nuance, a lot of devil in the detail, if you like. I'm not saying anything, you know, remarkably insightful here when I say that the US is a dramatically larger market, a lot harder to penetrate, a lot harder to collaborate on, but also very different in terms of data regulation, data protection authority, which has a huge impact on product and, you know, customer needs and things like that. And so in terms of how that can impact things, I would say very difficult, I think, in some cases, depending on your product, to really prioritize a market and the roadmap and what you should be committing to. There is, you know, we were just talking about Trump, right? There is this notion, as far as Trump's administration is concerned, that, you know, globalization is now out of fashion and we're moving towards, or ought to be moving towards, kind of
homemade goods. Yeah,
homemade goods and sort of maybe hyper-localization, I suppose. And if there is any truth in that, if there is more of a movement towards that, again, I think it's interesting to reflect on that when we think about the nuances and the differences that can emerge within markets, you know, more further fragmentation in the way that markets operate, their needs, and therefore the products and the services that need to be sort of provided within them. Loosely related to this, I suppose, there was a really interesting talk I joined a couple of months ago where someone from Spotify was talking about, and actually, I couldn't really believe this, to be honest with you, but when you look at the top 10 artists at any given point by market, by geo, they are rarely ever not an artist that isn't from that country. So I assume, for example, I sound really old now, but Taylor Swift is always top 10
in the US.
Yeah, or in Brazil or something like that.
Oh, okay, yep.
But the reality is it's always, almost always hyper-localized. And really the kind of core argument, if you like, within this presentation was this notion of further fragmentation and hyper-localization. And I think it plays into this point, you know, we could see more of this. And if you've got instances where UK-based companies feel the need to give more focus in the early stage to the US to get more funding, they could be under or overfitting to the UK. You know, we don't get a fair representation of the needs of the demands that we have, because they are often very different markets. the whole consent and privacy landscape is a really good example of that. Really good example. Mainland Europe, way ahead of UK by 2 or 3 years. There's a lot of products there that were totally irrelevant to the UK a couple of years ago, now very pertinent. Same in the US. There's a bunch of new products UK are looking at that frankly aren't too relevant to the US right now. And so I think there's sort of a risk there that, that might creep in.
Mm. Mm, yeah, Rachel, what are your thoughts on that?
So I think it's super interesting. I also do, you know, have a bit of a heart sink moment when you sit and look at some, you know, statistics and data that tells you about the volume of, you know, financial investment that happens for technology companies in the US versus the UK. And we know from the guys that work at First Party Capital who are specializing in early stage investment for early stage technology ad tech companies that are European based, how hard it is to raise money, even at an early stage level, for companies that are doing business in Europe and the UK. And you know, so it's not surprising, but it is depressing. But then there is another lens that we could use to look at this a little bit similarly to our, you know, sort of optimistic outlook in the previous story, which is that I still think that the UK is a great place for innovation and technology innovation specifically. It's perhaps a market where, notwithstanding data privacy and regulatory issues around products and product development, it's otherwise a market that can be fairly innovative, and it can be, you can take things to market to test quite quickly. I'm speaking mostly only from anecdotal evidence that I've gathered in the ad tech industry. This might be a bit different if you were talking about other types of technology companies in other industries. But, you know, if you look at the industries, the technology industries that are doing well in the UK, even things like you know, biotech and medical technology, which is a very regulated industry, probably the example holds true for those industries too, that there is a way or an attitude or a cultural approach to technology innovation that makes it possible to sort of get to a product fairly quickly, which is great. Therefore, the investment landscape for those early stage companies, like Matt mentioned earlier on, is quite good. There's a lot of tax breaks. There's a lot of incentives for people, individuals and small investment funds and small investors, to invest money in early stage startups, and that's great. I think the issue is we just need to scale that up. Rather than looking at how we access bigger pots of money, we should be looking at how we incentivize and facilitate investors to invest more money here and not elsewhere and not in other things. So the government needs to change its approach, I think, to investment, and it needs to not only create incentives for larger pots of money to be invested in businesses here, but it needs to create a viable economic market and landscape to make that investment level competitive. And the FT article mentions this. Someone, I can't remember where I read it, a while ago, but they were talking about how the Australian government routinely invests in offshore pension funds, or they use pension funds to invest in offshore technology markets and businesses, and the UK government don't allow that, and they should absolutely rethink any mechanism, that included, to get money out there to invest in businesses and invest in companies. And I can't believe that the current Labor government aren't seriously considering that, because that's been all over some of their financial statements and manifestos. They just need to skill up on that front. And then I think the other potential opportunity here is, you know, the other example that Matt gave is that companies either start here and then think about how to scale up over to the US, or they start in the US and think about how they can globalize. I think the other potential barrier for businesses trying to do that, it is a good strategy, is cost, right? You need a lot more money to set yourself up in the US than you do here in the UK. Things are super expensive. Hiring people is, but not that things aren't expensive here in the UK, but hiring people in the US is probably 2-3 times what it costs here. There might be less sort of barriers around hiring and firing people than there are in the UK and Europe, but it's not an insignificant outlay to get started over there. So I just think that if we could grow a really mature investment landscape here in the UK with a European mindset and a global mindset, you could take advantage of all of those businesses and think, well, I'm going to start here first because I'm cash strapped and I know I can get some early stage investment, and then I'll think about our US strategy. And that could work really successfully for a UK investment economy. We just need to get smarter at it.
I totally agree on that, by the way. I think it is worth pointing out, by the way, it really needs to be said, you know, UK has some of the best academic institutions in the world, some of the best, as you said, you know, sort of R&D capabilities, you know, tech expertise. And so it's almost naive, I think, to assume that, you know, over time, it's just going to be more and more of those capabilities, you know, of those skills and those jobs that are just going to move to the US, just based purely on kind of capital. And maybe, you know, to your point, maybe it isn't such a bad thing that the UK is just really good, just gets increasingly better at supporting those earlier stage, you know, support startup.
Well, it's where it all starts, right?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Just about trying to, I just think the UK, a good place to start is the UK government's approach to investment, because that's what's really helped to fuel the early stage startup investment landscape, is just think about how to extend that runway, right? Like, don't just focus on early stage. Let's think about what we can do to encourage wealthy individuals, family investment funds, other investors to invest much bigger chunks of cash. And never mind about the market restrictions. I think in the UK, often we're very obsessed with the notion that businesses grow in the US because they've got this homogenous effect, officially single language. It's not an official single language market. We know, you know, Spanish, for example, is very much a second language in the US, and there'll be some others close behind that. But let's say officially it's a single language market with, you know, just shy of 300 million people living there. So of course you go over to the US because there's way more opportunity and it's really easy to make money. Well, the 60 to 70 million people in the UK, you could argue it's still a discreetly potentially profitable market if you've got the right product and the right product fit and enough investment to give you a long enough runway to get that right. And there's plenty of examples of knock it out the park British businesses that are now global brands that you're like, how'd they do that? Always think of Gymshark, you know, some guy that set up bloody gym gear equipment in his mum's garage in Birmingham,
making us all feel awful about our life.
Yeah, totally. And it worked, right? And like, that's a massive global brand, and he was really focused, the founder of Gymshark was really focused on producing all of their garments in the UK, setting up factories in the UK, growing and building that business from here. God knows where that story's gone now, but you know, he headquartered, the headquarters perhaps is still here, but you know, he really grew that business out of the UK. He didn't start it and then get a bit of money and go to the US, he carried on here. So it's possible. There just needs to be more money in that middle stage, beyond early stage. And then if I think of ad tech businesses that have done really well in the US, either UK homegrown or European ad tech businesses, it's been years before they've really made a play into the US. And whilst that might have helped them grow and catapulted them, in some instances it's been organic growth. They've sent a team over there, set up and got going. In other instances it's been acquisition because it's been too hard to do that. They will still say they were significantly large scale businesses here before they were there. So there could be loads more investment opportunities.
Yeah, definitely a lot of opportunities there. And yeah, it's a great market really for companies to start in.
Absolutely. And, you know, fantastic. Also, geopolitical landscape and location, right? We underestimate those factors. There's been a lot of talk, you know, connected to the previous article, there's been a lot of talk about what this tariff and trade war political move in the US has done to its reputation as a stable economy. And as a result of these tariffs, there's going to be loads of trading partners out there who don't necessarily need to trade with the US and will start thinking to themselves, this is too hard. It's so volatile and so unreliable. I'm actually just going to focus on my APAC business because there's loads of people over in Asia buying a shit ton of stuff from me. So I'm just going to stop thinking about the US. And then I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to do lots of other things. The thing about the UK is, despite the fact that this sort of world of polarizing politics exists everywhere, it is ultimately quite politically stable and it's in a great geographical location to enable people to do business. So we just need more tax breaks. Thanks, government.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And now moving us on to the last story for today from the New York Times, looking at Meta's US antitrust trial. So Meta's antitrust trial over its social media dominance began on Monday. The Federal Trade Commission, the US Competition and Consumer Watchdog, alleges that it illegally maintained its dominance in social networking by acquiring Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp in 2014. Matt, how do you expect this case to play out?
I mean, goes without saying, right, this is a huge case that's unfolding before our eyes, kicked off this week. I think going on for sort of the next 7 to 8 weeks. and is so interesting, to be honest. Well, for most of us, I think, for us in the room at least. And I suppose, from what I understand, you know, from the FTC's side of things, they've basically got to demonstrate three key things, right? Firstly, that Meta possesses monopoly power in a defined relevant market, which, by the way, to get to your question, I think is where this case is probably particularly weak, and we'll perhaps come onto this in a bit more detail, but I think it's on that market definition, as is often the case with antitrust trials, that this thing is, you know, really quite weak, to be honest with you. Secondly, that they conducted, they were acting in an anti-competitive way, that they willfully acquired power rather than basically building superior products. I think if there is strength in this case, it's probably in that particular area, to be honest with you, and some of the revelations in the last couple of days, at least, that have come out within some of the documents. And that also that Meta has caused harm to competition. Again, I think a bit of a challenge for the FTC to prove, but, you know, we'll see, right? There's many weeks of revelations and unsavory words to be shared from the previous years. But yeah, I suppose, like, just on this first point and market definition, the really bizarre thing about this, it seems, looking through it, is that this case first came about in 2020. And there is this sense for me that the FTC is almost referring to a market that doesn't exist anymore, which, you know, exemplifies just how quick the tech industry moves, right? But their focus is very much, in terms of their case at least, that the competition is Snap. And I think MeWe as well. And of course, Meta are saying, well, hang on a minute. There's TikTok, there's X, there's YouTube, LinkedIn. I think that's a bit of a weak one, although sometimes LinkedIn does feel a bit like
a bit like a Facebook Instagram feed.
Yeah, Meta's perspective is that's totally not the case, that, you know, the competition isn't just Snap, obviously. And I think that is probably, as I mentioned, the area in which the FTC are particularly weak. I think it was yesterday, there was some really interesting evidence that was shared on the side of Meta, in which they showed when, for that very short period in which TikTok was down, there was a huge surge in engagement. I think Meta was 20%. Increase, YouTube was 14%. Red Note, Red Book, that
never even heard of them.
Right.
Red Book,
yeah, 14%. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
It was the Chinese alternative. That was quite hilarious, to be honest with you. Again, sort of further evidence of the fact that, hang on, the competition is clearly not just Snapchat here, and. Yeah, I think that's going to be the real challenge, to be honest, with this case. Having said that, there is probably some areas to this, particularly on that second point around whether Meta really did act in a sort of anti-competitive way, that maybe the FTC does have some legs, right? I think it was yesterday, there were some exchanges between Zuckerberg and his team back in 2018. Turns out he was thinking about selling off or spinning off Instagram because he was concerned around competition concerns and you know, maybe getting some attention there. I think he spoke way back in 2012 when potentially buying Instagram of neutralizing it to buy time, which really is in favor of this kind of wording that the FTC have used of kind of buy or bury, this buy or bury strategy to kind of prove their case. Maybe not the most sort of compelling evidence, but interesting, if not anything else. There were just 2 months, by the way, between Zuckerberg suggesting he might buy Instagram for $500 million and him actually buying it for $1 billion, which I think is maybe an indication of the urgency that he felt there was to really quash that competition.
Absolutely.
Which I think is probably what the FTC is going to really lean on and double down on. And I mean, it's absolutely striking to me as well to consider the fact that they purchased WhatsApp for $19 billion despite having almost zero revenue, because of those concerns around the competition with respect to chat. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of money given the revenue opportunity, at least, clearly because of the threat it posed from a chat perspective.
And
but yeah.
It sort of says something about the position that Facebook was in at the time, right? That it had those pockets to be able to knock their competitor out and just take them out of the game by purchasing them for a price that they couldn't say no to effectively.
Yeah. Exactly. But again, going back to this FTC point, I think it was towards the end of yesterday, actually. The FTC really tried to double down on this quote that was taken from Zuckerberg in 2006, in which on the market definition point, he had said that Facebook is about real connections to actual friends, which, I think is disappointing. This is a quote from Zuckerberg, 15 odd years ago, in an effort to frame it as, Snapchat being the only viable competition because that's the only one that's about, actual friends, this definition that Zuckerberg used 15 years ago. I mean, I think most people are of the view, and it's a bizarre position for me to be in, to be almost defending Meta, but I think on this particular case, it is a bit weak. It is going to hinge, I think, on the continued revelations around the strategy and the reason behind why they made these purchases. And I think really undermining Zuckerberg's credibility there, to be honest with you.
It's super interesting, isn't it? Because this case really makes me think, well, if ever there were some serious competition concerns, why did the deals get signed off in the first instance? Clearly they met all the legal requirements at the time. And I guess that's when you'd need to really sit down and look at the detail of the legal requirements that one needs to satisfy in order to complete a financial transaction versus the legal requirements that one needs to satisfy in order to defend yourself against some anti-competitive activity. But, that's where the US government needs to match those two lists up and go, well, perhaps the better thing to do would be to, make ourselves clear right at the outset what won't be tolerated. So you get the signing off of the transaction and the deal, and these are all the things that you need to be aware of because we'll come back and take another look at it in 5 years' time or something like that. I don't know. Because I really think that what's going on here is some other stuff behind the scenes. We all know it's been very well publicised that there is quite the parade of anti-competition lawsuits going on in the US at the moment, all for legitimate and solid reasons. We know that obviously the DOJ won their case against Google last year for competition in search. There's still an outstanding judgment that we're awaiting on for the US government's competition against Google for dominance in their ad tech stack. And I feel as though there's been lots of chat about this particular case being connected to the degree to which the Trump administration will be interested in getting involved, meddling with it, wanting to either support or pull apart. And I think that that's really multi-layered as well. Just having a chat with Kieron before we started recording, we were talking about there are prominent figures in the US government administration at the moment who feel really strongly about, because it's widely known that this particular case is considered politically bipartisan, I wondered how true that really is. And then Kieron was chatting about the fact that there's some prominent figures in the Trump administration who have made their feelings clear that they are very against the notion of a dominant social media platform because it's just not fair, goes against everyone's constitutional rights and freedom of speech, etc. And a lot of that sentiment has come from that Capitol Hill uprising backlash of a couple of years ago when Trump lost the following election and then was sort of deplatformed by some of these very said social media platforms. And so it's the idea that there are some US politicians and they've either got influence over legislators or relationships with legislators, and they're strongly pushing this notion that one of the reasons you need to push this case, guys, never mind whether it's weak or not, is because we need to make sure that this social media platform is not as dominant as it currently is. We need some way to break that down and to send the message that we'll be doing that to everyone that gets too big. Well, if that's the case, and if this case was found in favour of the US government as a result, then you could expect others to be, the eyes are going to be pointed towards others down the line. I mean, TikTok's already being dealt with via the banning. You could argue that YouTube being scooped up in this Google ad tech dominance case case could, whilst it might not be directly relevant, what the outcome of that could be a potential breakup of Google and its assets, and that might therefore remove the sort of level of dominance of some of those other platforms. So I just feel like it's not just about the case, but you are, I think, Matt, entirely right. From a legal point of view, concerning what they actually need to prove, I think that the government is in a fairly weak position. There's no doubt about it. We all knew it at the time, right, that Zuckerberg was buying both Instagram and WhatsApp to take them out of the market as competitors. But they've also, you know, the evidence has also been put forward to say that that was a legitimate business strategy at the time. Like, guys, let's not build. It's too hard to compete. Let's acquire. So that's actually him saying virtually the opposite of what they want him to say, which is, I'm not doing this to stamp all over the competition, but I'm doing it because I can't build anything as good as this. So this is a different way of innovating. We'll acquire them, bring them into our family, and turn them into the products that we want them to be. And that's a pretty compelling argument, actually.
Yeah, I agree. I suppose, you know, regardless of whether, also to your point, whether Zuckerberg wins or loses this trial, he has at least, we can say, lost his integrity, because, I mean, it is quite striking to see some of the actions of this man leading up to the trial, right? I was just having a look through and, you know, donated $1 million to the Trump inaugural fund in the run-up. I think he's visited the White House three times since Trump took office. The very timely, let's say, content moderation changes that he made.
Indeed.
To your point, by the way, on the administration, it's Brendan Carr, right, now chairman of the FCC, who wrote a letter to Meta and lots of the other big tech, saying it's exactly that thing that he takes issue with, that content moderation. So I think it's an interesting data point that shortly after that, content moderation is suddenly
vanished.
That, yeah. You know, the buying of the $23 million property in Mar-a-Lago by Zuckerberg, and the list really goes on, to be honest with you. So yeah, nice, I think reassuring to see that maybe at least so far all of that was completely in vain, and that, you know, this is going to go through court, and we'll see, you know, we'll see it to the end.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's going to be so fascinating to understand how it unfolds, you know, to watch how it unfolds, because understanding the context in a forever shifting landscape is what is making prediction here very difficult, right? You really can't say which way it's going to go. And you're right, it's totally unscrupulous behavior on the behalf of Zuckerberg, but, you know, he's a billionaire, so do any of them behave well? Let's be honest.
What can we expect?
They feel that, you know, they kind of all behave like they can buy their way out of anything. And I don't know, you know, if you're Zuckerberg, you could be looking at this through a different lens. He would never say this, of course, publicly, but to him, maybe it's like, guys, I made some legitimate acquisitions. You approved them at the time. And now, because I'm a multi billionaire, you don't like the idea of it. And so you're effectively slapping me with a massive tax. You're going to pull me through court, either break up my business or force me to break up my business. That's going to cost me money. Or you're going to, I don't know, slap a massive fine on me or something like that. Like, I think he's seeing it as, you're just trying to get more money out of me. And legitimately, they are, and understandably so. So, yeah. All the other contextual stuff just makes it a super interesting piece of reality TV.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's been exciting to see all this antitrust stuff going on lately. There's so much going on, and yeah, it's definitely going to shape the coming years a lot.
Totally. And I quite like the angle that actually, you know, the US government is you know, as sort of morally questionable as they appear at the moment, there's still some fundamental principles that they don't look like they want to shift on. That's what's making this interesting. It's not for the minute all about money. It's also about other things. So let's see.
Yeah, I suppose, like, just a final thing to add to this is, if not anything else, you know, regardless of outcome, what all of these big antitrust trials do, because it's worth noting, you mentioned Google as well, but, you know, there's lawsuits now against Amazon and Apple, is, I think, you know, they're giving perhaps entrepreneurial oxygen into the market, you know, this sense that, well, these big incumbents that have been around for a very long time are now being held to account, you know, will be challenged, and that there is opportunity for genuine innovation and kind of, you know, new ways of working. I suppose partly linked to what we were talking about previously, right, around the sort of the Trump piece, cause for sort of optimism. The other thing I was going to say is sort of to move on from this, linked to the AI point. I was looking at a presentation from an analyst, Benedict Evans, the other week actually came into our office and did a really good presentation, and was talking about these big platform shifts that we see sort of every 10 to 15 years. And, you know, we had mainframes and then PCs, then web and smartphones and cloud, and the fact that we might now be moving into this next phase that's generative AI. And I think what we're seeing with these trials now is a sort of a weakening, if you like, of these huge incumbents that would say that, you know, they're poised perfectly to move into this next phase of generative AI. But we can see, we look at historical data and actually sort of early indications that they're going to have a really hard time to move into this new phase and remain the dominant players that they are, right? Apple with Apple Intelligence. I think most of us are sort of struggling to understand why it's so difficult for them to fully integrate this, why they're so far behind. Google with AI overviews and AI mode, clearly stuck between a rock and a hard place. And really difficult to see how that pans out, you know, which side of the ecosystem, if you like, they end up messing about, because they're going to have to do it in some sense, going to have to commit to one side in order to provide that service. And Meta too, you know, sort of taking a slightly different approach or entirely different approach with open source, really difficult to know whether that's going to be the right route. And so I think with all of these trials, applying a lot of pressure to the incumbents, providing really fertile ground for potentially this new wave of innovation, this next cycle around generative AI and new entrants. Of course, we saw, I think it was yesterday, the announcement of OpenAI and their new social network, new platform. Maybe they'll be one of the next big incumbents. We'll see. They've obviously grown very quickly.
Yeah.
But it's an indication maybe of how the next wave of things could look like. I don't doubt if this is true, if it's going to be a platform that they announce, it will be dramatically different from how we've understood a social platform and a social network to be prior, right? Because it's going to be a truly AI native system that will be very exciting.
Yeah. And I completely agree. That's what's great about being a consumer at the moment. It's way more interesting. I'm not using, you know, Google Chrome for searching anymore. I'm using Perplexity and I'm using ChatGPT and I'm using a whole bunch of other stuff. And I'm also using Chrome, but it's not the same world that it was even 12 months ago. And that's a great time to be a consumer. So bring back more competition, 100%. And maybe also have a think about how, you know, what rules and what checklists you put in place to try to prevent dominance in the future, make it a lot easier, I'd have thought.
Yeah, I know it's so crazy though how AI has just transformed the whole ecosystem. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how OpenAI does with that social platform. It'll be really interesting because I can't really imagine
what it's going to be like. Yeah. I know it's going to be intriguing, right?
Yeah, really
no idea. I think that they're focused right on the rumors are it's going to be very much focused on sort of image generation. But yeah, for someone who doesn't work at OpenAI or work in product, it's very hard for me to understand exactly what that, I mean, I'm assuming there's going to be something agentic within there, and ultimately I'm going to sort of give some control to my agent who's going to basically manage my social media account or something. That, I mean, yeah, probably be a lot more exciting than that, but certainly very probably a lot of what Zuckerberg's trying to do early stages with Meta, you know, the introduction of sort of, you know, generative or sort of AI driven accounts and generative content, but much further ahead and, you know, a real sort of paradigm shift, I would say, because he's not going to be limited by all of the pre-existing kind of tech and infrastructure and ways in which they work.
And the 7 weeks that he's got to show up in court.
That as well. That's going to slow him down a little bit. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Well, I think that's all we have time for today. But thank you so much, Matt, for joining us. Thanks so much for all your insights.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been really great to join.
That's been great. And thanks as always, Rachel.
My pleasure. Fantastic discussion. Thanks, Matt, for joining us. Thanks for hosting, Amy.
Thank you. And thank you to all our listeners. That was today's Mad Tech Podcast.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.